The Irish are convinced that the Australian economy will systematically collapse. Martin North, John Adams, and Eddie Hobbs, in the interest of the people. Hello, John. Hello, Eddie.
Hello, Martin.
Hi, Martin.
Good to see you all here. And we're going to have a really interesting cross comparison between Australia and Ireland, but looking at it from somebody who's been through the Irish crisis a decade ago and is now looking in at Australia and drawing some quite interesting conclusions. John.
Yeah. So one of the reasons why I think this conversation is important is I've spoken to a lot of people across the country about what we saw in the market and the economy before the 2019 federal election that we just had last Saturday. But one of the things that I've noticed now, I've spoken to Eddie quite a few times, and I know you've interviewed Eddie a couple of times on camera, but every Irish immigrant who I speak to who lived through the crisis in Ireland in 2007-2008, they're all saying to me, it feels the same in Australia. We're going through the same pattern. A lot of these Irish immigrants think we're going to suffer the same crisis. They talk to Australians, native-born Australians, and the Australians don't get it. And so, so I thought it'd be reasonable to because Eddie's been looking at some of the bank data in Australia vis-a-vis and having a look at how that compares to Ireland. And I think it's worthwhile to go into some of these issues with Eddie about, are we on the verge of collapse? Because Eddie's written a couple of articles for the Irish Examiner this week. But the key point is that I continually hear from Irish immigrants, it feels the same, it looks the same. The reason why I think Irish immigrants are important is they lived through it, they smelt it, they saw it, they heard it, they felt it. Whereas contemporary Australians just don't have that experience of what does a systemic economic collapse feel like, look like. And can you identify it? So, I've been working on some stuff around early warning indicators, and this is where Eddie and some of these Irish immigrants have been saying, before you see the massive rate in increase in defaults or massive increase in unemployment, there's a whole bunch of early signs that you should be looking for. Most policymakers in this country and analysts don't know what to look for. This is why I think the Irish are super critical, because they know what to look for because of their experience. So I thought it'd be good to have Eddie on camera. Obviously, Eddie, the first thing is worth asking a question about is, you've written a couple of articles this week for the Irish Examiner about Australia. So you've written this for an Irish audience. So what have you been trying to communicate to your Irish readers?
The recent update from Endeavour Equity, I think Wallace Orr is the writer, took a deep dive on the quality of the Australian mortgage book itself. And I described it as a bit like the moment when we had an economist over here, Morgan Kelly, who did a deep dive on the bank balance sheets in terms of the scale of overseas credit that the banks were now using to drive the lending in the Irish market, and therefore had moved away from just recycling the deposit base into directly tapping interbank markets for just massive amounts of money. Which escalated in a very short period of time. So our private sector credit mountain went from a manageable amount, one could argue, to crazy levels, over twice GDP, which is where Australia is at, in a matter of a short few years. And that is the nature of bubbles. They're not linear. They happen exponentially, especially towards the latter end. And that's where all the danger period is. But what was really striking about the analysis produced is that when the analyst examined the mortgage book, he came to the conclusion that at least 40%, that's 4 in every 10, mortgage loans on the balance sheets of Australian banks are not prime loans. Even though they are categorised as prime loans, they are either non-prime loans, in other words, higher-risk loans than prime loans, or they're subprime loans. In which case they are very high risk. And the reason he's come to that conclusion is by really looking closely at the process of the underwriting of the loans and looking at the total level of income that borrowers are pushing into servicing their loans. And where those are in excess of 40-45% of your income, and where you borrowed initially at point of origin more than five times your earnings, your loan is not a prime loan. It's either non-prime or subprime. So 4 in every 10 is a huge number. So that arose my curiosity. So I examined it against the Irish situation. And when you do that, 40% comes up again, because on the basis of of your own data, 40% of the mortgage book held by the banks is on interest only. And in other words, capital repayment holidays of some kind or another. And of that, 80% of the interest only loans are in the investor area. And the investor area, according to your own data, I think is about a third of your mortgage book. So what we see when you look at it is that a third of the mortgage book is investor buy-to-lets. 80% of them are on interest only. Overall, 40% are on interest only. And 40% of the loan book is not prime. It's either non-prime or subprime. So you will say, well, why is all that interesting from an Irish perspective? And the answer is quite straightforward. When we hit the skids in 2007 and 2008, only 15% of the Irish mortgage loan book was buy-to-lets. Half of that, at 7.5% of the total, was on interest-only deals. There was interest-only activity in the owner-occupier market, which is 85% of the market, and that's split evenly between first-time buyers and those that are trading up or trading down or just switching their mortgage to get a better deal. So in other words, the vast majority of our loans were owner-occupiers, and owner-occupiers behave very differently to investors when you get a downturn. And that was another part, an interesting part of the research, which shows not just in Australia, but certainly in Britain and Ireland, when economists have got into looking at the data on arrears, you quickly find that initially the arrears are being created by those people who have mortgages and are just out of money. The money isn't there. So it's not that they won't pay. They cannot pay because of unemployment or their savings have run out. Typically, homeowners will shift heaven and earth to hold onto their home. So they'll burn through savings. They'll tap friends for loans, etc. And it's only really when they've no other room for maneuver that they go into arrears on their mortgages. Whereas investors have a different mindset. Investors will continue to service mortgages, but where the negative equity gap grows and it exceeds, it starts continuing to grow further down, and it starts approaching negative equity levels of 50%, then the investor mindset shifts where they perceive that the pain of continuing to service the loan is in excess of the pain of defaulting, then the defaulting begins. And so what you're seeing again is you don't get a linear outcome in these situations. It suddenly comes out of nowhere and it cascades. And that's the same case with arrears as they build on balance sheets of banks. At first, it seems like a drip. It seems very containable, seems like a slight aberration, a little bit more than average. But what's happening in the background is that lots of people are getting into trouble. They're burning through their own cash reserves. They're delaying the day when they'll actually default on a direct debit from a bank. And then all of a sudden you're dealing with arrears that seem to come out of nowhere. And that's what happened here. We had a very, very low arrears on the mortgage book of the banks throughout 2007. And it was really only when the crisis escalated post Lehman Brothers that the arrears started to become a very, very serious problem.
So it sounds to me as what you're saying is that on some of the critical parameters, things are worse in Australia relative to Ireland before the crash there.
That's correct. On the other side, and it's worthwhile exploring this, we were locked into, and we still are, into a common currency area. So that means that our central bank is in Frankfurt. It's deciding the base rate. We were lucky that the Irish burst happened at a time when it was global and, the interbank market in Europe gummed up. I remember quite clearly people going to banks, including myself, to the ATM. And when the sign comes up saying limit has been reached, we were all wondering, are they talking about my bank account or are they talking about the bank itself? Because banks were getting into very serious trouble. People were taking cash home. they were hiding it in the attic or under their mattress. They were buying physical silver and gold. It did look as if the banking system was near collapse, and not just in Ireland. So we had the ECB, we're locked into their pricing. They initially began to increase interest rates under Trichet, which seemed to be crazy, before they started to decrease interest rates. But it wasn't until 2012, when there was a change of leadership at the ECB, did we begin to see quantitative easing, American style, being introduced, and then the bond yields, which had spiked over 7% for many of the countries, came down, and everything seemed to just cool down a little bit. So over that intervening period, obviously we were very reliant on the Troika, which was the IMF, the EU, and the ECB to give us support, temporary loans, that type of thing. So there was no end to how much debt they were prepared to give us, to provided we kept to the terms and conditions. And the terms and conditions were pretty straightforward. The Republic of Ireland taxpayers were expected to carry the load to bail out the European banking system itself. Because had the bondholders been burned by government policy here, it would have caused a knock-on effect, especially in the German and French banking system. So we bailed out Europe, even though Europe bailed us out, if you can follow that convoluted thinking. But that's what happened. Now, Australia is different. Australia is in control of its own currency. And this has been put forward as some kind of a magic carpet ride out of a trap. Now, there is a trap, and the trap is the debt is excessive, and maybe in a while we'll come to the moves being made this week. And the suggestion is that in the event of anything close to a systemic crisis, what Australia will do is allow its currency to free fall, perhaps to half its present level, and thereby create a boom in certain parts of the economy, particularly mining and tourism, and that this will allow people to shift their occupations, maybe even their geographic location, in order to generate more income, and everything will be fine on the night. And I find that remarkable, because if you allow your currency to go into free fall, then you're going to have an issue in servicing your foreign debt, especially your foreign debt in other currencies. And your bond yields could spike. You could have a European type spiking and a crisis, which means that credit markets will begin to turn on the borrower itself, which would be amazing given where Australia is starting as a AAA rated borrower. There isn't a silver bullet. There isn't an easy way out. You can't magic away a massive housing bubble with some strategy like that. So there's pros and cons to it. So when people say, well, Australia is different from Ireland because Australia is in command of its own currency, that is correct. And that certainly is an advantage. The Irish advantage was we had a lot of solidarity, albeit it came with strict terms and conditions, especially from the ECB, the EU and the IMF.
Sure. Eddie, one point I just want to sort of make crystal clear, because I'm going to make sure certain members of Parliament watch this. So you are one of the guys that called the Irish housing crisis. And if I heard you correctly, you, based on what you've seen in Ireland, based on what you've seen from the Australian data, you're saying that the underwriting standards in the Australian situation is worse than what the Irish banks got up to. Is that your view?
Yeah, what I'm saying is that the profile of the mortgage book is much riskier, because 4 in every 10 are on interest only, and a much higher proportion are investor loans. And when we look at the data, when things go badly south on arrears build up, it is clear that those are the areas, you know, where the arrears will rapidly escalate in comparison to the owner-occupier market. I mean, owner-occupiers only get into arrears and default, not strategically, but when they actually don't have any money to pay the mortgage.
Sure. Okay, so I mean, look, so I think that's a really critical point, because a lot of Australians, from politicians to bureaucrats to analysts in the banks, you know, they won't acknowledge that point. So so we've got it now on record that someone who called the Irish housing market is saying that the banks in Australia got up to more risky activity than what the Irish got up to. So I think that's critical. Now, one thing I just want to get a quick answer on is, I got a phone call from a politician in the last 24 hours, and they said, well, Ireland's different from Australia because Ireland had this super low corporate tax rate. They had a massive increase in investment by multinational firms, and that's what caused the boom. It wasn't the housing market. It wasn't the banks. And so the nature of the boom and the bust is fundamentally different to the Australian economy. So, this was something said in a recent TV debate I got involved in, but certain politicians actually have said this to me privately as well. So to what extent did the corporate tax rate and the investment by multinationals into Ireland led to a booming economy and to the bust?
Well, I mean, if you look at the Australian history, I mean, it's from an outsider perspective, it's a great story. I mean, the mining boom created by the development of the whole Asian economy is well documented. The mining boom then creates a boom in the service industry, which is all built around the flow out from that and feeds into a housing boom, which then feeds into a housing bubble. These are classic steps. And the argument you're suggesting is that the Irish boom was obviously not created from mining. Quite clearly, we don't have those type of natural resources, although we have very good renewable resources. It was really based around a catch up. Ireland was very far behind where it should have been on many, many metrics throughout the 70s and 80s. But the single greatest asset that Ireland has, like a lot of other economies that don't have natural resource endowments like Canada or Australia, has been the quality of the education system, the availability of a very mobile, highly educated workforce. And that has been a boon not just to foreign direct investment, but also to Indigenous Irish companies. And of course, you have a very strong Indigenous Irish food industry. So the idea that we have some kind of a lopsided, non-mixed economy, which in turn created the housing bubble, is far too simplistic and it's incorrect. Ireland's economy is quite diverse. Yes, we have a lot of FDI, but FDI is in Ireland because of the aforementioned asset of a young, mobile, highly educated workforce, many years younger than the European average, English speaking, etc. And it's attracted a lot of that. Our low corporation tax rate, our headline rate, certainly is low, but it has been for decades. It predates that strategy of low corporation tax, predates our entry into the EU, or the EEC as it was originally called. So it's very much been a long-term feature of the Irish economy, and it will remain so. All of the studies show that foreign direct investment is attracted into Ireland initially from the low headline tax rate. But when you get into the corporation tax rates that have been levied in many other countries and you allow for all of the deductions and the bookkeeping tricks, let's call it that, that you're allowed, the effective rate of tax in many European countries is not too unlike it is in the Republic of Ireland. So that doesn't stack up too well. So the Irish housing boom was built classically, just like the Australian boom has been built, on the availability of cheap credit being pumped into a property, an asset class that's out of favour. It suddenly begins to rise. The banks then decide to create even more credit behind it. More people come in behind that credit. And then you get the self-fulfilling prophecy of the upward only rising asset class. We had that. That happened throughout the dot-com boom burst, if you remember that, which meant that stock markets fell dramatically throughout the world. And we had the whole Bush support to try and reverse that in 2001, 2002. Meanwhile, Irish property continued to rise. So it did seem that Irish property was a miracle. It was exceptional. This time it was different. More and more people got behind it. Credit loosened and loosened until finally we had 40-year mortgages, interest-only mortgages, mortgages tracking the European base rate, mortgages being given out with very little proper underwriting, especially at the development level of the market. More banks coming in, wanting to emulate the banks that were making vast fortunes on the back of all of this, huge support from European banks lending to Irish banks behind the Celtic Tiger miracle. None of those were doing so on the basis that it was purely a one-way bet on foreign direct investment. So we had a classic bubble, and eventually bubbles weaken and they pop, and that's what happened. So I can now what we're really talking about here, I think, John and Martin, is, you know, the delusion. I've said it before, that the closer to the precipice, the greater the deafness grows. There's so many people, there's so much skin in the game between stamp duty in Ireland and stamp duty over in Australia, stamp duty receipts, local levies, every Tom, Dick and Harry, solicitors, mortgage brokers, accountants, all of the professions, including in our case, our most senior barristers in the bar, absolutely up to their gills in debt and property. Everybody was in on the game. The government was in on the game. Most of the parliamentary representatives were in on the game. So you can understand that when you get individual voices standing up and saying, actually, the emperor, we think, has no clothes, the mob turns on the voices. And that's, again, classic behaviour. So, I you know, in terms of calling the burst, certainly I was writing and talking about the fact that this was utterly unsustainable, et cetera, et cetera. But, I mean, it would have been largely led by better voices than mine in Ireland. Morgan Kelly, I think, had a huge impact. Professor Morgan Kelly and David McWilliams as well was also very adamant for many years that this was going to end in tears, and he was proven correct. But what nobody saw coming was the degree to which the global financial system had become integrated and all of the wiring underneath and how all that was going to transmit from one economy to the other, and banks were going to fail without massive supports. And, I mean, they're continuing on. If we look at the European banking system today, Deutsche Bank is not in a good place. And a number of the Italian banks are not in a good place. And this is 10 years after the events. So the degree of non-performing loans in the European banking system, the last time I looked at it, it was greater than the capitalized value of all of the European banks publicly quoted.
Yeah. So it's very interesting. There are some interesting parallels, differences, but I think the parallels certainly stand out. And one last question, Eddie, before we wrap this up. We've just had some intervention here in the Australian market since the election, where effectively they are trying to encourage people to come back into the market and, you know, access credit. Did you have those same behaviours in Ireland before the crash as well?
Well, I mean, if I wanted to use a pretty gritty example, I was watching the third episode of Chernobyl last night, which was a really startling report on what happened during the nuclear fire in Chernobyl in 1986. And the powers that be knew that they were sending people in that were going to be very badly hurt as workers, and yet sent them in anyway, made attempts to downplay what was going on. When you look at the intervention in Australia, and I can understand the thinking behind it, I think there's a very serious concern about the degree to which credit growth is slowing down. If credit growth goes anywhere close to zero, you know, it's game over. So there's a serious attempt to try and get consumers to digest greater amounts of credit. And that's what this is about. So interest rates are almost certain to be cut, as I understand it, in June, by the Reserve Bank of Australia. But more importantly for me, which is just remarkable, is to see the loosening of loan underwriting by the regulator happening in conjunction with the rate cut. So the message going out to borrowers who are thinking of trying to get in is it's game on again. Now, this is the narrative of the soft lending, you know, that we are now at the bottom, and the soft lending narrative is that we're now going to take another leg up. Meanwhile, developers who would be very nervous and sitting on the sideline are beating their way back into the market, delighted, because there could be one last window of opportunity to develop out what they've got and sell it to the very, very last in to the source of the fire before the whole thing becomes an inflagration. And I'm not saying that lightly, because the scale of the debt is such that that it cannot be dealt with in the manner that they expect to, which is to add more debt to the existing debt on looser terms and not expect a very bad outcome.
Eddie, that's a very, very important message, I think. And it's one that, of course, we've been saying here in Australia. Very interesting to triangulate it with you. So thank you very much for your time today. And John, Eddie, I think it's true to say that we are facing right into a crisis.
Yep. Yeah. So I think the message from today is they may attempt to delay the crisis. They may attempt to come up with different rationales for why Australia is not a crisis. But we've heard from Eddie. I hear from other Irish immigrants that it is the same. There's a bubble, and it is the day of reckoning is coming.
Indeed. Thank you all very much, Martin North, John Adams, Eddie Hobbs. In the interest of the people. See you next time.